Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of A Stab in the Dark, the alibi podcast that investigates the worlds of crime fiction and TV crime drama, that brings them into a dimly lit interrogation room, plies them with tea and cheap biscuits, and through a cunning blend of astute questioning and brute force, gets to the truth. Looking back through our archives, which you should definitely do, we've been privileged to talk to some of the biggest names in both genres, but just when you think we couldn't get any bigger or better, we've only managed to get one of the most prolific, best-selling, and annoyingly talented writers out there. In a 30-year career, Harlan Coben has written over 30 books, selling 70 million copies all over the world, and now he's started to write TV shows for channels like Walter Presents and Netflix to boot. See, I told you he was annoying. We'll be talking to him about his illustrious career, his move to TV, and quite probably all manner of other stuff, just because we can. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark. So, Harlan, welcome to A Stab in the Dark. Thank you very much for doing this.
How's it going, Mark?
It's going very well, mate. It's going very well. And with you?
Good. It's great to talk to you. It's always fun to talk to you.
Well, listen,
we've known each other a fairly long time now, haven't we?
We have. 20 years, I should imagine, something like that.
I remember going out with you and John Wood right before your first book came out.
Wow. What did we do? Did we go shoot pool or something?
He was whining that he didn't get it.
Well, actually, I'm going to mention John Wood during our discussion because, anyway, we'll get to that. We'll be talking about the TV adaptations in a little while, especially Walter Presents Just One Look. But first, I want to talk to you a bit about how you got to where you are now, your journey, your struggle, Harlan. As you say, we've known each other a long time and we've both been doing this nonsense for a while. And you always get asked, you know, what's the secret? How do you keep going? What makes you keep doing it? So there you go. I'm not letting you off the hook. How do you keep doing it?
Keep doing it. I think part of it, as you said, the struggle. You know, my first New York Times bestseller, London Times, whatever bestseller, was Tell No One. That was my 10th book.
Right.
That wasn't my first book. That was my second book. It was my 10th book.
Yeah.
So not that I'm, you know, not woe is me struggle, but I had a really great appreciation when the good things started to happen. And, I like them to continue.
Well, do you know what? What is sad though, is that that story, somebody that's written 9 novels that haven't broken through and then break through with the 10th would not happen in the publishing world today. Certainly not in this country. You wouldn't get 9 books.
It's hard to say yes and no. I mean, when I started, one of the early things, when I started the Myron Bolitar series, I was a paperback original. They printed 15,000 paperback, mass market paperback originals. I had an advance of $5,000. And not to brag, but by the fourth book in the series, I was up to $6,000. So it wasn't over. But the thing is, you know, here's the thing, Mark. We didn't know anything back then. When you first started to come, you knew a little bit more than we did. But so I had no idea that I was a pimple on the ass of publishing. I thought I was kind of hot shit, you know? I mean, I had a book published, sometimes in a store. I didn't have an Amazon ranking that said 3 million on it. I didn't know any of that. So I just kept going along, you know? I knew I wasn't doing great, but I wasn't that discouraged either. And I think today, and you get the same thing, you get emails from people saying, you know, I published 2 books, sort of self-published 2 books. How come I'm not selling like you and Grisham?
Yeah.
It's an interesting world.
The other question you get asked a lot, of course, is where you get your ideas from, where you get new ideas from. I have a specialist ideas website and a team of poorly paid children, but how do you do it, Harlan?
I don't know. I mean, this is the only thing I do. It's the only thing I do okay. So all day long, I kind of have a part of my brain that's asking, what if? And so when I see something, you know, The Strangers coming out on Netflix. So one day I was online and I saw an article about a woman who faked her pregnancy. And so I did a little digging and she faked her pregnancy by going to a website called, I don't remember what it was really called, I fictionalized the title, fakeapregnancy.com. And she went there and you could buy, I looked at it, and you could buy bellies, you could buy sonograms, you can buy fake tests that when you pee on it will come out positive no matter what. And I'm like, holy crap, what if I was hanging one day at my kid's soccer practice and somebody came up and told me my wife had done that? That's the start of a book.
Right.
So it's basically, I'm making it obviously sound easier, but it's all these always asking what if about everyday normal events that normally are what lead me to that first opening hook.
Is that website notreallyknockedup.com still live?
There's actually two of them. I did some research. When you watch The Stranger, you'll actually see we have a website up there and have seen when Richard Armitage looks through it. And it's pretty much exactly what that website is. We changed it. We had to fictionalize it for ourselves. But nothing is different than what the actual website is. I found two of them. One kind of pretends it's serious, where it's saying, maybe you're having a surrogacy birth and you don't want anybody to know. And the other one is like, you know, fool your friends, prank your pals, go to a costume party. So, but both are sort of saying the same thing, and it can have nefarious. Our job, Mark, as you know, is to make it. Find a nefarious reason for that.
But how good are these pals going to be? How close to these pals can you possibly be if they suddenly see you at a party 8 months pregnant and go, wow, I had no idea. You're obviously not close with these people, right?
Well, that's the funny thing. When you look online, they have it's so clear what it's doing, because they have ones that here's for a belly 1 to 3 months. Here's a belly 3 to 6 months. Buy three or four different bellies and things like that. And then start thinking about what other stuff going on the internet can I play around with that we all think we are completely anonymous? But of course, somebody is making that order at pregnancy, whatever, fake a pregnancy, mm-hmm. right? There's a human being somewhere along the line that knows what you're doing. And so once that happens, we have a habit of thinking what we're doing online is secret. And of course, it's not. This is just one example.
Right.
But I do this all of the time. I mean, I'll give one more quick example. A few years ago, I wrote a book called Promise Me. And the idea for Promise Me came when I overheard two teenagers who I loved dearly talking about drinking and driving. I mean, we've all heard. And I pulled them aside and I said, Promise Me, title of the book, you won't do that. Here's my phone number. Call me at 3 a.m. I don't care what you're on. I won't tell your parents. I'll pick you up, blah, blah, blah. Maybe you've done something similar to a lot of people. And in real life, nothing else ever happened. But what if? What if somebody called my hero, in this case, Myron Boletar, a young girl? He goes to New York City at 3 a.m. He picks her up. He drops her up at what he thinks is a friend's house. The next day, she's gone. That's how I come up with ideas.
There you go.
As best as I can tell.
So just going back to the beginning, when you weren't this runaway success straight off the bat, was that frustrating? Did you have expectations? Were you kind of, why isn't this happening?
Not really. I'm not saying this because I'm such a great, patient guy. But one is, as I mentioned before, I thought I was doing okay. You know, I'm having books published. That was the dream, right? What's your first dream, Mark? Well, your first dream is not to make a lot of money or to hit your first dream is just to one day
see your book in a bookshop. Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
So that was all. And then it was, you know, my expectations have always moved up slowly. So it's like, gee, wouldn't it be great if I could do it again? Gee, wouldn't it be great if I could scratch out some kind of living making it? Gee, wouldn't it be great if one day I could skim a bestseller list? So it goes on like that. And I was having enough good things happening, an Edgar nomination or whatever else, and I'm a person who celebrates the victories. So I was always fairly encouraged and had confidence in myself that it would happen, but I wasn't disappointed. I had a I was a published author, and that was kind of magical in its own right. Now that's not so magical, right? But being published by Dell, which is a major house, even if it was a small time, felt like a really big accomplishment. And I was really proud and pleased to be getting the $5,000.
I had an odd experience recently in that I now narrate all my own audiobooks, but I didn't initially. So I've now had to go back and do the audio versions of books I wrote 20 years ago. Now, that's a chastening experience to reread. Do you ever go back? Do you ever look at those old books? And what do you think?
I'd be the same sensation I had, but like halfway through, during you would just stop and go, wow, that's really bad. Can I change that?
Yeah. No, you can't.
No, you can't. I never reread my own books, except now with the adaptations, I have to. And sometimes I'm pleased and sometimes I'm not. And I know I've been accused of over-twisting, which is a fair assessment, that I have too many twists in my books. And even as I'm sometimes reading some of the old ones. I just had to read The Innocent, which we're making in Netflix Spain. And I was like, where the hell am I going with this?
But do you feel
that maybe I over-twist is fair, maybe.
Do you feel like you're a much different writer now than you were then?
Different, probably. Much different, no. I don't know if you agree with this or not. It's very hard. I mean, I think I'm slightly better. Other people will say I'm not, which is fair. But I do think we learn as we go along. I'm not sure I have the energy. I really look at some of the early books when I had, 30-something viewpoints and all of that. I don't know. I just think, you learn something, but you probably are, you have to, in a sense, repeat also. I don't know. The answer is I don't know. I'm definitely different. I don't know if I'm better or worse. Some books probably better. Some books probably worse. That was a crappy answer, but that's as good as I can give you.
That was a fine answer. So that first book, Play Dead, right, 1990, then 2001 rolls around and Tell No One happens. New York Times bestseller list, adapted into a movie. What is it about that book that you think made that difference? You mentioned John Wood earlier on, and I knew John back then, and I remember a phone conversation where he'd just acquired Tell No One, and he was just giving me the hook over the phone, yeah. And I just went, "That's gonna work." Was it that? Do you think it was just that? Here's this pitch that is irresistible.
I don't know. I think that's part of it. Part of it was that I had written 7 straight Myron Bolitar novels before that. And no matter what you do or say, there was an audience who were going to assume those were sports books. And they would not read them. The sports books are not going to read them. So part of it was that I had left that sports world. Part of it was something new and different. I think the hook, that hook. And the movie poster had the hook. It was 8 years ago. Beck's wife was murdered. Today he got an email from her. Big. That was the end of that. That was the French movie poster. So it was a lot of things. It was a way I had, a lot of goodwill and done okay, but it was a chance also to remake yourself. It's one of the reasons I yet believe a series. It's hard to break out with the 8th Myron Bolitar novel.
Right.
So I think that, there's that book, and you just get lucky too. A lot of it is just sort of luck and it catches on. And it really, it was life-changing overnight.
We should mention for the benefit of our readers exactly who John Wood is. We're throwing his name around with gay abandon and rough familiarity. He was your editor at the time,
yes.
Right?
John, I was the first buy John ever had as an editor with the Myron Bolitar series, One False Movie, bought in 1997 or 8 or something like that, when he first came to the office. And then when he moved publishers, he took Tell No One with him, and we were together a very, very long time.
And now, of course, he's become an agent.
Yes, and now he's an agent.
Yeah,
now
he's poacher turned gamekeeper, or is it the other way around? So you're writing standalones pretty much one a year, every now and then going back to Myron. Was the last Myron Bolitar novel 2016, I think?
It might have been 2017 or 18. I don't remember.
Okay, and even though they are standalones, there seem to be some themes that recur. Disappearance. You do love a disappearance, Harlan.
Yes,
people who aren't quite what they seem, especially within a family unit. What is it about those themes in particular that you find so compelling?
I like disappearances because, the same way that Agatha Christie would have written about murders or Philip Roth wrote about the Jewish experience, I like disappearances because it adds another layer. If somebody's dead, they're dead. We can't really, you know, you can solve the crime, you could have justice and all that sort of a thing. But if somebody's missing, you have the chance of being made completely whole. If somebody's dead, they're never coming back. So when someone's missing, you know, you have hope. And hope is a fun thing to write about because hope can make your heart soar. It can crush it like an eggshell. And so I think that's the thing. It adds another layer for me. It ups the stakes because now, as I said, you know, you can have full redemption. It's a different kind of distress than a murder is. And so for the most part, that's what I like to do, is doing the disappearances.
So I asked you if you thought you were a different writer now than the writer who wrote Play Dead. And you said quite tellingly, I think, you know, I'd like to think I'm a better writer, or I might not be a better writer. Do you still have that? I mean, and I guess the day you think you know everything is the day you should quit, right? But do you still have that sort of imposter syndrome that so many writers seem to suffer from?
I don't know. You have, come on, Mark, you have imposter syndrome. I know you too well to not know that you, we all have this. Only bad writers think they're good. These days, you know, it's a very strange paradox, because on the one hand, we think we suck. And on the other hand, we have the hubris to say, please read me for 400 pages and pay me for the pleasure.
Yeah.
So it's, and that's a contradiction, but that's a contradiction that we all sort of have.
We got a break coming up. Before we go to the break, you've got a new novel coming out this year, The Boy from the Woods. Tell us a bit about that.
The idea for The Boy from the Woods, again, to give you an idea, I was walking through the woods, which I hate to do. I was hiking with my family, and I saw just a six-year-old boy kind of running around by himself. And I thought to myself, what if right now we found a six-year-old boy who had always been in the woods, has no memory of any time before the woods, thinks he was always raised there, used to break into houses or lived off the land. And we took him in, and nobody knew who his parents were, anything like that. And now 30 years pass. He's a grown-up and still doesn't know what happened, what kind of character would he be? And that is the boy from the woods.
We'll be talking more to the brilliant Harlan Coben about his TV work, why on earth the French love him so much, and what's next for him. But now it's time to see what our roving reporter, our man with the spyglass, Paul Hirons, has been up to. Paul, what's the word on the streets?
Yes, thank you, Mark. I am joined now by up-and-coming British crime novelist Fiona Cummins, who's released, well, she's released three books. She's about to release her fourth. Fiona, welcome to A Stab in the Dark.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I want to go back to the beginning. You had a career in journalism. Well, not right back to the beginning, obviously, but in your writing career, because you were a journalist, and then you made the jump into writing crime stories, and you're debut Rattle won rave reviews, and it was a really scary story of a particularly demented serial killer. Had you always been fascinated with serial killers, and is that something that you wanted to explore straight away?
I think I've always been fascinated by the darker side of life. I think the shades of grey in all of us, and I was working as a journalist on a big busy national newspaper at the time, and then a couple of things happened. I went on maternity leave and with my second child, and my sister-in-law, to whom I'm very close, was diagnosed with a stage 4 lymphoma, which is a type of blood cancer, and it was advanced and it was aggressive. And then a few weeks after that, and just after my second child was born, my oldest child, who was not yet 2 at the time, was diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening condition. And both of those things kind of pulled me up short and made me think about where I was going and what I wanted from life. And what I'd always thought about doing was trying my hand at writing a novel. So that's what I did. I just probably driven more by emotion than sense at the time. I resigned from my job, and I thought that I would have a go at writing a novel. And so Rattle, my debut, when it first went out to publishers, it was more of a combination of horror and crime rather than kind of more pure crime, I think. And I was asked to make it more of a crime novel. And so with that in mind, I focused much more on the identity of my killer, of my villain, as it were. And I mentioned earlier about the sort of shades of grey. I am really interested in serial killers and the psychology behind why they do what they do. But perhaps even more than that, it's this idea that you can be doing very brutal, very dark things, and yet you can still love someone, or you can still do a kind act, you can still care about something. And I was fascinated by this. I didn't want to write a caricature. I wanted to write a character who was 3D, not 2D.
Right, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because you see a lot of serial killers, or read about them in books and see them on TV and on the movie screen, and they are a bit cartoonish, aren't they? I mean, I would even argue that Hannibal Lecter, perhaps the greatest of them all, has got that kind of almost cartoon villain about him, certainly in the Anthony Hopkins adaptation. So that was important to you, to make a serial killer a fully rounded human being with some believable characteristics and motivations.
Well, absolutely, because how many times have you heard, you know, somebody when they're interviewed in the press after discovering that their next door neighbour has, you know, butchered multiple people or has been, you know, I don't know, on a murdering rampage, and they said, oh, you know, he was a quiet, friendly fellow, or he kept himself to himself, that kind of thing. And I'm always sort of fascinated by that. In my work as a journalist, I kind of covered many news stories in which people were never that suspicious about, you know, people who were committing these kind of brutal acts, and found that really that idea really fascinating. And also, I do have my kind of agent to thank in some respects, because, you know, when I was writing early drafts, she would scribble over them, yes, but why? And that was her question all the time. And it's a question I try and think about now with every book that I write, which is the why. You know, why somebody kills, you know, somebody kills, they don't just kill for the hell of it. I suppose there is a very tiny percentage of people that might do that, but there is always a reason. And again, it's this whole debate about the nature nurture, you know, because actually, you know, in some of the research that's been done, lots of people that go on to kill, that go on to commit these kind of brutal acts, have grown up in extremely difficult circumstances, have been exposed to all kinds of violence or, you know, sexual abuse, or seen things that they shouldn't have to see. And I think this influences how people behave. And there's some really fascinating new research coming out about also how people that go on to become serial killers have sometimes sustained a head injury in their kind of early years. And this has gone on to change the way that their brain works.
And it is a constantly fascinating subject, especially the nature versus nurture argument. And as I say, you know, your serial killer certainly has sort of intriguing elements to, well, his or her personality. Let's not give the game away too much. You wrote a follow-up called The Collector, where this serial killer popped up again. I think every serial killer in fiction has to have a thing, a modus operandi. And as I say, this serial killer that you've written is particularly, you know, horrible. Not that your usual serial killers aren't horrible, but you know what I mean? This one's particularly demented. Could you tell us what that serial killer's MO was?
Well, it fills my black heart with joy that you think that it's a particularly demented modus operandi, because I was trying to think of something that would make my serial killer unique, that would make him a little different, because I think actually those are the most memorable characters. And often, you know, readers, they don't necessarily remember plot, but they remember a character who's made an impression on them. And he was a collector. A collector of, I don't know, specimens who have some very extreme specimens. Generally, they have suffered from some kind of bone deformity, and he collects them for his family's museum. And then when he's collected one of his specimens, he also has a calling card that he leaves, which is the skeleton of a rabbit, because he keeps rabbits at home. And he uses beetles, live beetles, to clean the flesh of his museum specimens, as the museums actually do. I mean, they don't do it now, but when I was writing this, the Natural History Museum used exactly the same species of beetle that I used to clean my museum specimens. Wow. And I went down there and spoke to their forensic and advisory identification service, who were absolutely brilliant. And I said to them, imagine I'm a police officer and I turn up at your door with this kind of rabbit skeleton, and I say that this has been found at my crime scene. Can you talk me through everything that you can about it. And that's exactly what they did. And a lot of that conversation is kind of recorded verbatim in the collector. So I wanted to create something dark and something that hadn't really been done before. That was what I was trying to do anyway.
I'm not going to have my lunch for a while now after you speaking about that. But I wanted to talk about real quick about the latest two books, The Neighbour and the forthcoming, I believe, When I Was 10. You seem to have broadened out the themes there. The Neighbour has sort of elements of domestic noir in, and When I Was 10, I mean, there's a very strong familial element here, isn't there? The unit of the family, the kids getting involved in the cases, this kind of whole idea of the perfect lifestyle coming under threat. Is that something that kind of you just naturally gravitated towards being a wife and a mother?
I don't think it's so much that as I am interested about kind of the dark theme that runs through ordinary life, everybody's ordinary life, I suppose. And I guess having children particularly kind of has influenced the path that my writing has taken, I suppose. And, you know, relationships, marriage, those kind of things, you know, because they are at the forefront of my mind and they occupy, I suppose, a lot of my thought process. But I am interested, I suppose, in, as I said, the sort of dark heart at the centre of family life. Because and I like the idea of having a detective, having a crime, and, you know, having it from the kind of killer's point of view as well. I'm fascinated by that kind of three-tiered strand, almost, as it were. But yeah, I suppose, you know, certainly with a neighbour, that's much more a domestic setting.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it just appealed to me. I guess I was worried in some ways about my writing being too dark and alienating certain readers. I didn't want that to happen. I guess I wanted to broaden it out a little bit too. But you'd find in, you know, all of the books and my new book too, that there is, again, it's this kind of shade of grey. It's about having characters who, you know, are more than who you think they are. And I think that's kind of something that's always interested me and always will. But I did, yeah, I wanted to play with a domestic setting because actually I think in some ways that's the most frightening thing of all, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, the danger is coming from within the home rather than outside it. And we all live on, you know, we all live in homes and streets, have relationships, children, family, all of those things. It's universal.
Absolutely. When can we look forward to When I Was 10?
So at the moment, When I Was 10 is scheduled for release in August. But obviously with the ongoing pandemic that we're all experiencing and the kind of troubled times we're living through, that could well be subject to change. So it's just a question of waiting and seeing at the moment. I'm not sure a decision has been made on that yet, but potentially it could be moved. But yeah, and that's kind of my latest book. And again, was inspired in some ways by, you know, another killer, but this time by Mary Bell, who is some of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with her story, in which she was responsible for the murder of two young children when she was 10. And the trial, I think, was when she was 11. And this kind of age of, you know, I wanted to explore particularly this idea of are we all entitled to a second chance? You know, if you've served your time, should there be a sense of redemption? I'm particularly proud of this book. I can tell you a little bit about it if you like.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so it tells the story of Dr. Richard Carter and his wife, Pamela. And 21 years ago, they were stabbed 14 times with a pair of scissors by one of their daughters in what's become the most infamous double murder of the modern age. And then their daughter, 10-year-old Sarah Carter, spent 8 years in a children's secure unit for the brutal killings and is living quietly under an assumed name with a family of her own. And then to mark the anniversary of the trial, a documentary team tracks down her older sister and they compel her to break two decades of silence. But it features a journalist who I absolutely loved writing. It's got a memoir of Parliament in it. And it follows what happens when a major news story breaks, and obviously drawing on a lot of my experience as a journalist from that, and how what happens in the press can fuel events outside of the press as well. So, yeah, I really enjoyed writing it.
Great stuff, Fiona. So, When I Was 10 could be out in August, but keep an eye out for, yeah, who knows? It's such a crazy time at the moment. But once again, Fiona is exploring, as she says, the dark heart of human behaviour. So do look out for it. And with that, it's a big thank you to Fiona, and it's back to you in the studio, Mark.
Thanks, Paul. We're back with international best-selling author Harlan Coben, who we're chatting to thanks to the wonders of modern technology. Harlan, let's talk a bit about the TV work. Just One Look is out now to watch on Walter Presents in the UK, as is No Second Chance, which is also available on Walter Presents US outlets. You've written stuff for Netflix. Did you always want to get into TV?
No, I actually had no interest in getting into TV. I mean, I'd optioned things the same way that we all had and just sort of dismissed it. I don't think it interests me to, you know, in America, most of the TV series back in the old days were 22 episodes long, where you had to solve the entire crime in 44 minutes. And that really had very little appeal to me. And I've been warned very early on by a very smart editor that too many novelists had gotten lost by going out to Hollywood and lost their way. And if it could destroy guys like Faulkner and Chandler and Hammett, and it would crush me like a little bug. So I actually stayed away for a very long time. I optioned things that never happened, and some did. But for the most part, I completely stayed out of that until a few years ago.
But it has now happened, and you do seem to be quite involved.
Yeah, the difference is that, first of all, I think with the streaming services now, we can do it in a different way. So, you know, The Stranger will be 8 episodes long, almost an hour each episode. I can expand my world. I have a lot of control. I don't get a lot of network notes. Netflix has been a joy sort of to work with, and especially the ones in the UK where I'm working with Red Productions and Nicola Schindler as my partner. This is the third series we've done together. We did Safe in the Five. And for those who don't know, don't recognize Nicola's name, but you know her shows, Happy Valley, Last Tango on Halifax, Years and Years, Queer as Folk. I can go on and on.
Uh-huh.
Scott and Bailey, all those shows Nicola Schindler was the producer on. So she's a great partner to work with, and I've really kind of enjoyed it.
I've known many writers who've had their stuff adapted for TV or have written for TV, and they, certainly if it's a book adaptation, they feel the best thing to do is kind of not get involved, because that way if it turns out to be terrible, they can say nothing to do with me. And if it wins a hatful of Emmys, they just go, hey, that's my book, you know, kind of a win-win situation. But you're not doing that. I mean, you have had stuff adapted. Obviously, we'll talk about that in a minute. But this is something that you're creating specifically for television.
Well, both. I aren't too much of a control freak anymore to do that. And the other thing is, as I was saying before, so I've written, I think Boy from the Woods is my 32nd novel. That's a lot of time alone in a room.
Yeah.
And while I'm naturally an introvert, a socially adept introvert, I think we call ourselves, so I'm happy alone in a room, it's been nice to kind of get out and to work with other people. You know, Danny Brocklehurst is my main writer, and Richard Fee and Nicola Schindler, and then these actors, in this case, Jennifer Saunders and Richard Armitage and Siobhan Finneran and Hannah John Kamen and Paul Kay. I got to work with Stephen Ray. I got to work with Anthony Head in this show. And so it's been fun. And then after I'm on set for 2 or 3 days, I start to lose my mind and I want to get back alone in a room.
Yeah.
So weirdly enough, they seem to work to increase my productivity rather than taking away from it.
Oh, that's interesting. Those are great people to work with. I know Danny adapted 2 of my books to the BBC. He's such a fantastic writer and a thoroughly nice guy who we've had on this show, in fact. But from being alone in the room where you are God and your characters are doing exactly what you tell them to do and nobody else is interfering, this is a cooperative production. It's, other people have input. They have. Do you still find that tricky on a day-to-day basis?
I found it less tricky. First of all, I work very hard in finding people to work with that I like and respect. And I try not to be that way. It's more to me now, since, like, you know, when you're a novelist, you are birthing the kid and the kid's at home with you. But at some point, the kid has to go to school, even though you're not sure they're ready. And you're at the door and you're watching the kid get on the school bus and you're panicking about it because other people are going to be with your kid now, but your kid's going to be okay. And so far, that's how it's been. And I don't like not having the pressure on me. So you're going to watch The Stranger on Netflix. If you don't like it, blame me. I mean, I like to change things from the books too. That's another thing. I think it's a little different, but I like that pressure. I don't really want to like just have my kid go to the school and never come home from school. I want to watch the kid. Maybe I'm peeking through the windows at the school. Maybe I'm waiting on the playground of the school, but the kid's not home with me all the time.
Right.
That's a really stretch of analogy there, but just go with it.
I've gone with it. So what's next TV-wise? Any ambitions to direct, to star?
I don't think direct, but I don't know enough about the camera. We have The Woods is coming out next, and we just finished filming it. It's Netflix Poland.
Wow.
And it's a beautiful adaptation, completely different than The Stranger. It's moody and atmospheric and very Polish, and I kind of love that hybrid. That'll be out sometime this year. And the third that'll be out this year is The Innocent is being filmed for Netflix Spain. And it stars Mario Casas, who's a huge star, and a great director is doing it, Oriol Paulo. If you haven't seen on Netflix, has his movie Invisible Guest, which stars Mario Casas. It's one of the best thriller movies I've seen over the last 10 years. Yes, you have to put up with subtitles, but let's all grow up. We learned from Parasite, it's time we all started to get into that. So if you have Netflix, I highly recommend a Spanish film called The Invisible Guest, directed by Oriol Paulo, starring Mario Casas, who are right now filming The Innocent as we speak.
Well, you're clearly conquering Europe country by country, but it seemed to have all started in France. Yeah. Just One Look is an adaptation of the 2004 novel, now a French series. Oh. What's the deal with France? They just seem to, France aime le Harlan Coben. Why? Why are you such a big deal over there?
Are you French? That accent.
I know. It was amazing, wasn't it?
It was like I was in Paris cheese shop.
I'm even doing the shrugging. I'm shrugging as you. I have that French shrug down pat. No, but seriously.
Yeah, like when I go there, the first thing I do is I buy a beret with my name stenciled on it.
Right.
So that way they know I'm a local.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, I sold a lot of books in France and had a lot of fun and success. Maybe they're smarter. No, but I don't know, but I'm thrilled with what's gone on in France. It's been, I'm the Jerry Lewis of crime fiction, I guess, big in France for some reason.
Uh-huh.
It was already doing well, and then I think the movie Tell No One that Guillaume Canet directed really kind of put it over the edge. Then we made the TV show No Second Chance with Alexandre Lamy, as he mentions on Walter Presents. Now Walter Presents is doing Just One Look with Virginie Loudéon, who, if you watched, you may know Virginie Loudéon. Some of you maybe remember the movie The Beach with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Sure.
She was the lead woman in that.
Okay.
Wonderful French actress. I don't know, but I really love my relationship with France. And it's fun to do well in France because they have a great deal of respect for the author. And that's so, it's really been, I'm just lucky, an incredible experience.
Well,
words I'm going to say I'm lucky.
In my experience, they've always had a great deal more respect for the genre generally than you get in a lot of other countries, and I think that that probably applies to both our home countries. When you go over to France, you don't get any of that snobbery about mystery fiction, a genre fiction, that you can get here and sometimes in the US. I've been out there I was out there doing some events a few years ago with George Pelicanos a long time, and it was like being with a god. They really do. There's none of that kind of, oh, you write mystery novels or you write crime fiction. It's, le noir or le roman noir. And they take it very seriously.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of countries. I find Poland's the same way. I find Poland has a great deal of respect. Germany, too. It's just they have a great deal of respect for story and the writer. The writer is the most important thing to them. They're not quite as starstruck, perhaps, as some other. But who knows? I mean, again, I never know. Why? And you're probably the same thing, Mark. Your books are in dozens of countries. Why does it do well in Italy and not in Spain? I can never really quite figure those things out. But a lot of it has to do, of course, with luck. I mean, there is luck involved too.
Oh yeah, so much luck. If any writer, I'm not sure what you say when newest writers ask you, you know, how to make a living out of writing, how to get published. You just go work hard and be lucky. I think they're pretty much the only two things that you can advise, aren't they?
In all due deference, is true of pretty much everything in life.
Yeah,
you know, everyone. The person who will just tell you it's because of their sheer hard work and they did it all by themselves is a liar.
Yeah.
They just are. And whenever I've met billionaires and a millionaire, and whenever I really talk to them for a moment, there's always that moment, or more than one moment, of luck, complete and utter luck, and that could have gone the other way. That's life. So, you know, you move on.
Well, listen, thanks so much for talking to us, Harlan. But just before we let you go, we're going to put you on the spot now. We always ask guests on the show for a quick recommendation on something to read, something to watch. So is there a crime novel you'd like to recommend to our listeners and something you've watched on TV recently?
I just read her advanced copy of her next book, but I think she has one already out, Janelle Brown, one really to watch. So I'm not sure. I think one's called Watch Me. I'm terrible with titles, but Janelle Brown.
Okay.
Her new one's called, I think, Pretty Things, but that's not out yet. Wonderful writer. I think that she's going to be a name we're going to hear a lot from.
Okay. Okay. Thanks for that. What about something to watch on TV?
If they can find
something that hasn't been written by you. I mean, something else.
I'm watching The End of the Effing World right now, which I know is a couple years old.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Aren't they great?
Yeah.
My God, I met some of the cast members in Cannes a few months ago, and wow, it's really a fun show, and I'm really enjoying it. And Naomi Aki, who stars in season two, was in The Five, played Gemma in our TV show The Five, so it's great to see her working her comedy chops as well. So that's one I'll recommend.
Well, thank you very much. A huge thanks to the mighty Harlan Coben for joining us. And remember, you can watch all the best crime drama every day on Alibi, available on Sky, Virgin Media, BT and TalkTalk. If you've enjoyed this podcast, then take a couple of moments out of your busy day to review, rate and subscribe. It takes but a fleeting moment and makes a huge difference to us and the future of the podcast. If you don't, well, we might have to send the boys round. Okay, we haven't actually got any boys, but we'll send a strongly worded letter, so let's see how you like them apples. We'll be back with another brand new episode of A Stab in the Dark very soon. Until then, a special thanks to our producers Paul Hirons and Joel Porter. My name's Mark Billingham, and thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, you've got an idea for a business, the store of your dreams. There's just one thing to figure out, everything. That's why Shopify's all-in-one commerce platform makes it easy to sell online, in person, and everywhere else. Sell on social media, source products with an app to get that first sale feeling. It's the only solution that gives you everything you need to sell everywhere you want. So when you're ready to bring your idea to life, power it up with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.